This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Deregulation has led us to this point where the cost of living is high, the wages are low, minimum wages will not provide a living standard for people. About half of Americans are on the verge of living in poverty.
Yeah.
So we're at a time where workers are speaking up.
Workers are getting angry with the lack of COVID protection in Iowa. Dear UAW workers have had enough.
Many of our faculty members were very concerned over COVID safety and really over any kind of lack of specific plan coming from the college administrators.
In Texas, a Collin College professor has been fired for tweeting about COVID. Will free speech rights survive COVID and Twitter? From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt, of Pacifica's KPFT Houston. We began today's show with a global day of action that took place on January 27th to support 5,000 striking workers at South Africa's Clover Dairy, the largest dairy company in Africa. The workers are fighting a 20% pay cut, layoffs of over 1,000 workers, and asset stripping by an Israeli billionaire family, David and Dorit Wortham, who bought the company in 2019. Rallies were held at Israeli consulates in Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and around the world. In New York, WBAI Building Bridges' Ken Nash was at the Israeli consulate, where he interviewed Carol Lang, a professor at City University, New York.
What's disgusting?
Union busting!
What's disgusting?
Union busting!
Union busting!
And I'm here with Carol Lang, who is one of the organizers of this demonstration for the Clover workers in South Africa. We're outside the Israeli consulate of the United Nations. Tell us about why the demonstration is planned for today.
This demonstration is really unique. It's one of the most international demonstrations that's happened in recent times. The Israeli company Milco has bought up Clover Dairy Company in South Africa, and they've laid off probably at 600 or more workers, raised the hours that people have had to work. People are now on strike. But the unique thing about this is that the South African workers who are on strike, and which is led by a socialist, is also calling for the end of apartheid in Israel. So that the discussion is not only about South Africa and Israel and the oppression of by the Israelis of the South African workers, but they're calling for unity with the Palestinians, which is what makes this demonstration excellent and unique.
The Clover workers, exactly what kind of work do they do, and what are their grievances?
The Clover workers are dairy workers. There was a milk industry, and now the Israeli company Milco took over the milk industry and has laid off many workers. The rest of the workers are now being forced to work in conditions that are subhuman. They work in freezers because that's where you have to store the milk and the dairy. Because of that, they are out on strike. What they're calling for is the end of the agreement between the ANC, which is the government in South Africa that has sold out the masses ever since it got into power, since 1994. But they're not only asking for nationalization, they're asking for workers' control, that the workers take over the factories and run it in a cooperative way. So it's not that they want the ANC to take over the factories and run them, they want the workers to run them as a worker cooperative, which makes it really unique. The Palestinians are in absolute support of the Clover workers, because the Clover workers understand what the company wants to do is make this area in South Africa a distribution center for the milk and have the Palestinians, whose territories are being more and more occupied by the Israelis, do the work, milking the cows, making the products, and then shipping them to South Africa. So not only will the South African workers lose their jobs, but they understand that what their deep connection is with the Palestinians. And so they're calling for the end of apartheid in Israel as well.
And the South African workers have also incurred wage cuts, right?
They had wage cuts, they're working longer hours, they're working on holidays and Sundays and not getting paid for it. They're just like regular days. And so Milco is like any other capitalist corporation. It wants to maximize its profits. And because the South African workers have gone out on strike, the company is beginning to employ the same sort of tactics in the factory as it is in the occupied territories in Palestine. They're shooting people with rubber bullets in the factories now. So it's incumbent upon international socialist workers to defend the South African workers.
And what can those people that are hearing this interview over WBAI, what can they do to help? Where can they find information to pressure the South African government to do the right thing?
My group, the United Front Committee for Labour Party, is actually the initiator of this demonstration. So they can go to our Facebook page, our email address, and check out what's going on, what could be done. This is being publicized in South Africa now. The South African workers know that there's a demonstration going on in New York and in California and possibly one in Milan, in Italy. So I know it's cold and a lot of people don't want to come out in the cold, but this thing is actually getting a tremendous amount of traction now. So they can email us.
What's the email address?
The email address is committeeforlaborparty@gmail.com.
That was Carol Lang, a professor at City University, New York. In San Francisco, retired longshore worker Jack Heyman of the International Longshoremen Workers Union Local 10 spoke at the rally in solidarity with Clover dairy workers in front of the Israeli consulate.
We're out here this afternoon to express solidarity with the striking Clover workers in South Africa. The Longshore Union has a long history of solidarity with the working class in South Africa. I want to begin by expressing our solidarity with the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, with the South African Federation of Trade Union, that are solidly behind supporting the striking Clover workers. We in the Longshore Union in 1984 struck against a ship in South Africa to oppose the apartheid regime. Nelson Mandela was in prison at that time on Robben Island. In 1990, he was freed. And when Nelson Mandela did his world tour, one of the first places he went to was Oakland, right across the bay. And Nelson Mandela spoke at the Oakland Coliseum. And some of the first words out of his mouth were that he wanted to acknowledge the instrumental role that the Longshore Union played in sparking the anti-apartheid movement in this country. We're out here today to let the Zionist government of Israel know that we're keeping an eye on what they're doing to the workers in South Africa, not only during the apartheid days when the Israeli government supported the apartheid government of South Africa, when they offered them nuclear weapons Against who? Against the black and colored people of South Africa? Who did the Zionist government have intentions of loaning that to? A racist, fascistic government. And today they're treating the workers, the clover workers who are striking for their jobs, they're treating them exactly the way the apartheid regime would be handling things in South Africa. When you struck, they didn't recognize trade unions. But now they're part of a trade union movement. The problem in South Africa is that when the transition was made from capitalist apartheid to a black government, black-centered government in South Africa, the transition was not made from capitalism to socialism. The Freedom Charter of the ANC called for nationalizing the mines and the financial institutions in that country. But the ANC leadership of Thabo Mbeki, and at that time, back in the 80s when they were striking against apartheid, Cyril Ramaphosa was one of the leaders of the trade union movement. He became a corrupt capitalist. He is now president of South Africa, and it's because of his role today in supporting and bolstering the neoliberal capitalist regime that they are oppressing workers like the striking clover workers. And we're here today to say to the Israeli government, we struck against your ships during the apartheid days. More recently, we honored picket lines by the Arab Resource and Organizing Committee and the Stop Zim Action Committee pickets against your ships in the Port of Oakland in the year 2010 and again last year. We made sure that Zim Line ships, the Israeli company Zim, was not worked anywhere on the West Coast. And we're going to express that kind of solidarity today. We're putting the Israeli government and the owner of Clover, the Wertheimer family, on notice. If you continue to oppress the Clover, striking Clover workers in South Africa, we're prepared to take solidarity action as we have in the past. Victory to the Clover workers!
That was the voice of ILWU Local 10 retired longshore worker Jack Heyman.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? And which side are you on? South Africa's got a problem. A push to privatize as Israel milks their labor system. It's how they neoliberalize. They laid off half the workers, cut wages of the rest. It's time to take our power back. It's time to disinvest. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Which side are you on? By Pat Fahey, live from the Clover protest. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. At Collin Community College in Texas, a professor has been targeted and fired for, in part, mentioning the death of a fellow academic due to COVID on Twitter. I interviewed fire professor Laura Burnett and her attorney, Greg Grubel.
There was a recent headline that Texas history professor Dr. Laura Burnett was fired from Collin College for tweets over COVID. There was an article that was published on January 28th that mentioned she was fired along with Audra Peaslip and Suzanne Jones. You guys represent 2/3 of the leadership of a local chapter of the Texas Faculty Association, a non-bargaining union, were informed that their contracts were not going to be renewed due to objections from the senior administrators of Collin College. tell us, Laura, how did this all come about?
My colleagues, Audra and Suzanne, were part of the leadership of the non-bargaining faculty union. I was not part of that leadership, but I supported my colleague Audra's efforts and my colleague Suzanne's efforts to petition our college leadership to take COVID more seriously. Over the summer of 2020, as we faculty were kind of recovering from the collective exhaustion that all of us had of, you know, pivoting to online, and students were exhausted, faculty were exhausted, administrators were exhausted, and planning for the fall, many of our faculty members were very concerned over COVID safety and really over any kind of lack of specific plan coming from the college administrators. The deadline for making a decision about how the fall format was going to go kept being pushed out and pushed out. There was a lot of lip service paid by college leadership to listening to student concerns and some talk about a student survey that was conducted saying that students preferred online instruction when, as it turned out, the only survey they were relying on were enrollment numbers. And since they weren't offering online sections at that point, students were enrolling in the only classes available, which were mostly face-to-face. My colleague Audra put together a multi-page white paper stating the latest research on COVID, safety concerns, the importance of masking, social distancing, the impossibility of doing that in an enclosed environment really adequately, and circulated this statement and invited fellow faculty members to sign it. A third or more of full-time faculty members at Collin College signed this petition, which basically requested the option to be online. It asked for the college to provide online as much as possible. It wasn't a request to pivot to full online or anything like that, but just to give those who needed to, for health reasons or, you know, concerns for people and their family, the option to do so. We were pretty vocal about that during the summer of 2020. We were vocal on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, those of us who signed the statement. That seemed to anger the college president, Dr. Neil Matkin, and he was said in emails to the faculty that he was upset that people were worried about signing the petition. Several people had expressed concerns that if they signed it, they might be retaliated against by the college leadership. And he said in an email that, and this is just so ironic, he said, you know, retaliation doesn't happen here at Collin College, and whoever is spreading that rumor is going to have to answer to me. Don't be scared to, you can always tell me the truth. And anybody who says you can't tell me the truth is going to have to come into my office and explain. That was just kind of typical. And the college president, it was very clear. He was committed to going face-to-face, and it was very much about enrollments. And he was also very clearly something of a COVID denialist, minimizing the pandemic in emails throughout the summer.
There's a quote in this article that said you were on his radar again in January 2021 mm-hmm. with a tweet countering his assessment that the pandemic was blown utterly out of proportion. That was his quote. And you shared something to the contrary.
He had said that during the summer. One of the comments that he made to faculty who were deeply concerned about face-to-face teaching in the middle of a pandemic. He said in an email, this pandemic has been blown utterly out of proportion by the media. The numbers are not as bad as the media has been reporting. He said that in August, and in October, a Black woman, Iris Maida, who was teaching as an adjunct in the nursing school, died of COVID. And she was the first, but sadly not the last, Collin College faculty member last year to die of COVID.
And you were warned about this tweet rather than offering a condolences to the family or just saying, right. Look, the college is going to issue a statement and send flowers or.
Yeah, no, I tweeted kind of regularly through the fall about the college's handling of COVID. I also tweeted about national politics, the election, you know, tweeted things critical of the Republicans in office. Somebody complained to the college president about my political tweets, and he told Jeff Leach, a Texas legislator, text exchange, oh, she's already on my radar. Yeah. So I guess I was on the college president's radar for being vocal about COVID. In January of 2021, an adjunct professor from Collin College, who had worked at the college just the semester before, apparently, died of COVID. And I tweeted about that and I was reprimanded. And the reprimand accused me of not being fully accurate because he was not employed at Collin College at the time that he died of COVID. He was not working for the college. And I had, you know, I'd simply noted, you know, another Collin College professor passed from COVID. That was my tweet. They were reprimanding me for requiring that my social media presence be factually accurate. And believe me, I wasn't attempting to mislead anyone. My understanding was that he was employed at the college, and I wouldn't have called him a Collin College professor otherwise, but he was, you know, listed in Rate My Professor as a Collin employee. He was on the faculty adjunct list. Yeah. So as far as I knew, he was still currently an employee. And I was also reprimanded because the man's obituary, to which I linked, did not specify that he died of COVID. So if you can imagine this, I got a reprimand because I dared to provide information to the public about this gentleman's passing that was not actually in the obituary that I linked to. It was just the most persecutorial approach that the administrators yeah. took. It's very clear why they do this. They're desperate to control public knowledge and public perception of yeah. them and their leadership.
Well, the interesting thing, you were reprimanded for, they said that your statement was not factual.
Right.
However, we know factually that COVID is real and that people are dying. Well, let's talk a little bit to Attorney Greg Grubel. He is with the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. FIRE is the acronym. Greg, you wrote a letter to the college president advising him of Burnett's rights and reminding the president of the college constitutional obligations to free speech.
Yeah, actually, that was my colleagues, Adam Steinbaugh, in our different sort of group that we work for here with the FIRE, were the ones that authored those letters. So I didn't do it myself. I had a lot of people working for Laura over here, not just me. And, you know, they did send, I believe they sent three letters to President Mack. They ignored all three of them. That's why, you know, when the college said earlier this week that they decided to settle her case because they didn't want to toss taxpayers' money, we gave them the opportunity three different times to stop doing what they were doing, and they persisted nonetheless. So we eventually did the only thing that you can do when you end up with a situation where the county government doesn't feel like they're accountable to anyone, and that's to file a federal lawsuit. That's what we did, and we won.
Let's talk about the First Amendment. Do you see in this climate that we're in now that we are at risk, meaning the public or professors, for exercising their First Amendment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think you have to look very far, unfortunately, to see that it does happen. And then it's been happening, you know, across the country. It doesn't matter what political party you belong to. It matters which political party your president belongs to, apparently, because that's usually what we see, that someone in charge has a certain viewpoint about how they think the world is. And if your views do not conform with that, then you will be fired. It's simply for speaking out and speaking your mind. What Laura did was absolutely constitutional. She was sitting at her home and tweeting about a matter of public concern, a vice presidential debate, and trying to get some actual information into Twitter that was accurate. That's hard to do. So, you know, we have seen this across the country, unfortunately, and you know, the only thing that we've been able to do is to put attention to it and to have wonderful clients like Laura, that from the beginning, Laura was very clear-eyed about this. She was doing this not just for herself, but for all the professors out there that encounter censors and end up losing their job just for speaking their minds.
That was former Texas professor of Collin Community College, Laura Burnett, and her attorney, Greg Grubel. classic music by John Handy, Hard Work, recorded in 1976. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Last October became known as Striketober as workers walked out throughout the country. The treatment of workers during the COVID pandemic was one of the motivations for the walkout. Ed Fallon of Pacifica affiliate KOHI 89.1 FM in Ames, Iowa, interviewed Joe Henry about the UAW John Deere strike, why it happened, and the cost of the pandemic for working people. Henry is the state political director for the League of the United Latin American Citizens, Iowa, and national vice president of Forward Latino.
Joe, welcome to the studio.
Good to be here, Ed. Thank you.
So we want to talk about the history of the John Deere strike. Just to make sure people are familiar with John Deere, a big manufacturer, huge number of employees, farm equipment, think big combines, and they hadn't been on strike since, 1986?
Correct.
And went on strike this past year, and that turned out okay.
It turned out okay. There are things that could have been improved, but for what it was... just kind of indicate here what they won after a third vote on this was 10% raises, restore the cost of living adjustment, preserve the pension for new hires. And at the same time, John Deere's incomes went up billions of dollars.
Yeah,
the same period of time.
The company did pretty dang good in 21. And, there were plenty of industries that didn't do well during COVID, but John Deere was not one of them. They were soaring. And so there was a lot of pressure for them to share that benefit with workers who had not been on strike again for a long, long time because overall things had been going well. I think, wasn't there a strike back in 2015, though, that didn't go that well for the workers?
With John Deere?
Yeah.
I don't remember that one on that. But I think, with this one here, 10,000 workers out on strike at John Deere. Mm-hmm. This was part of Striketober. And this was
Striketober. I like that.
So this was a very important period in labor history. The last time we had these type of monumental strikes on a national level was back in 1997 with the UPS Teamster strike.
Okay. And you were involved with that.
I was involved with that. That involved about 200,000 workers at that point. So this is interesting. This comes at the same time where the workers had been demanding for the right to elect their national leadership, which will occur in June of this year for the UAW workers.
Yeah, we've seen some significant labor activity during the COVID pandemic. And I hope that's a sign that we are going to see an increased power among workers through their union representatives. Do you see this ability of workers to gain benefits through the striking and negotiating process? Do you see that continuing into 2022?
Well, it's going to continue because after 40 years of what we will call Reaganomics, which started in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan became president, began deregulation. And that has continued on through all the administrations, including the Democratic administration. So deregulation has led us to this point where the cost of living is high, the wages are low, minimum wages will not provide a living standard for people. About half of Americans are on the verge of living in poverty.
Yeah.
So we're at a time where workers are speaking up because their backs are against the wall.
Well, and also you've got working conditions that are way subprime. These are not comfortable environments to work in.
And they're subprime due to deregulation, again, which started in the 1980s. So federal departments like OSHA do not enforce the unsafe working conditions that exist, especially with COVID that broke out in 2020. OSHA was not enforcing recommendations from the CDC on social distancing, PPE, the speed of work, closeness of work that happened, checks of workers on whether or not they had been infected by COVID. None of those things were enforced in 2020. And of course, again, regulation through the government has been non-existent for decades now.
Now, I know here in the heartland, the COVID was a real problem in the meatpacking facilities where workers are just shoulder to shoulder and dealing with some very dangerous equipment and of course, dead animals. And a lot of workers at Tyson and JBS and other meatpacking plants did come down with COVID. Many died.
Right.
And our state government's response was pretty anemic. Did we see any kind of similar outbreak at some of the John Deere facilities in the upper Midwest?
No, not really, because due to the fact that the meatpacking industry, these processing facilities are so vacuum tight, they were becoming Chernobyls during the outbreak of the COVID. And there was no social distancing. Workers were shoulder to shoulder with sharp knives, having to cut meat at a high rate, sometimes actually cutting into the arms of their neighbors. So it was difficult, and it continues to be difficult in meatpacking with about 500,000 workers nationwide, 26,000 workers here in Iowa.
Now, the one COVID incident I'm familiar with from the John Deere strike is a very unfortunate one. The head of the Des Moines local, Curtis Templeman, he had contracted COVID and died shortly after the third contract agreement was signed. That was tragic. And I don't know if there were other cases of COVID among plant workers or union members, but that one was significant because of its prominence.
Right. And very unfortunate. And I think that's also indicative of the fact that, we never resolved how to deal with COVID. How do we enforce CDC guidelines? Has OSHA changed since Biden became president? Where is the enforcement?
Is it better under Biden than it was under Trump?
It's a yes, no, maybe. when we look at meatpacking, we haven't seen the type of enforcement that has been asked for by the UFCW, national leadership that represents about 80% of the workers in meatpacking. So lots of work needs to be done. Lots of talk has been going on. But when it comes to really providing enforcement on a state level, that has not happened.
Just historically, back after World War II, there was this huge rush of labor activity that was very positive and very effective. And some people are thinking, well, maybe we're seeing that again. I mean, COVID certainly isn't as bad as World War II in terms of its human toll, economic toll, and other impacts. But it's been bad enough, and the response has been, the pandemic has hit different businesses, different individuals, different communities in different ways. But some are saying, well, one of the reasons we're seeing this resurgence of labor activities because of the impacts of COVID. Is that fair? Is that accurate?
Well, no, definitely COVID has led to the speaking out of workers. But also the other thing that needs to be noted is that, when we had this strike activity and this mobilization of workers after World War II, we had more progressive leadership within labor because of the affiliation of the CIO with the AFL. But due to the Red Scare, the McCarthy period, many progressive leaders were forced out of leadership positions within the unions. And we had this really low energy period where we did not have the type of leadership that workers needed to speak out about the safety in the workplace.
Well, I think many people are hoping that what we're seeing now, not just with John Deere, but with Amazon, with Google, with a lot of other big corporations, Starbucks, that this is not just a flash in the pan. It's not just a response to a current crisis, but it represents an understanding that, working conditions are not great, wages, benefits, a lot of other details about, how the employer interacts with the employees is not the way it should be, and that we're seeing this pushback. I mean, and to one degree, that pushback is evidenced by how many people are saying, nah, I'm really not interested in this job. There are a lot of folks who are just like backing out of the workforce because it's not the kind of conditions they value.
Well, it's about democracy in the workplace, the right of the workers to elect their own union leadership on a national level. The Teamsters just had their national election in November. So they have new leadership. And what has this new leadership stated? What did they state in November? They said, be prepared, companies where we have workers such as UPS. Be prepared for us to go on strike to fight for the rights of workers, safety in the workplace, better wages, and health care for all. We are going to do it. The members elected us into these positions, and that's what we're going to do. So the Teamsters is actually one of the main unions coming out of 2021 with new leadership due to the demands of the workers and the members in that union who voted for leadership to take on these struggles. So I think that is indicative of what you just stated.
But we'll see where it goes. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Folks, we've been talking with Joe Henry. He's the state political director for LULAC, Iowa, and the national vice president of Forward Latino. This is Ed Fallon. We're coming to you from the heart of America's heartland in Des Moines, Iowa. We're with the Fallon Forum, and we broadcast every week, have been doing so for 13 years. Thanks for tuning in.
We'll now hear from UAW Representative J.D. Neal at the onset of the John Deere strike in October 2021 in Des Moines, Iowa. The interview was by Laura Belen, author of the blog Bleeding Heartland, and journalist George Clark.
J.D., can you first explain what concerns led to the strike?
We feel that what John Deere put out in front of us wasn't fair, and we're fighting to receive what's fair, and not just for us, but for the labor movement in general. This isn't just about us. It's about the middle class working Americans. So we're fighting for us right now, but we're also fighting for everybody else. We're showing what strength in numbers is about.
The vote was really overwhelming, 90% to reject the contract. Why do you think it was such an overwhelming vote?
That's a strong statement saying the working class is tired of corporate greed and the corporations padding their pockets and not sharing.
So Deere has had since 1997 these two-tier contracts, so the long-term workers get a better deal than the new hires.
Yes.
And in the past, those contracts have been approved. But what do you think changed that people aren't willing to agree to a contract that's a lot worse for the newer hires nowadays?
Because people are starting to understand that benefits the company. That does not benefit the workers. The last contract passed by less than 200 votes. Mm-hmm. So it was very close the last time. And I think the people that voted no or yes last time, I think they paid attention this time, and the results were over 90% across the UAW Deere chain.
This is the biggest strike in Iowa in decades.
Yes, it is. Decades.
The fact that you were deemed essential workers during the pandemic, the fact that the stock prices for Deere soared, the fact that your CEO got a 160% pay increase in 2020 alone, can you speak to how that factored into the decision to go on the strike?
It pissed us off. 100%. You called me essential. We came to work every single day, and we continue to make you millions, not millions, billions of dollars. And you say you want to give us 5 to 6% up front. It's a slap in the face.
How much extra work were your members taking on during the pandemic? How many extra were you working 6 day weeks?
Some people would work 5 day a week, some people would work up to 7 days. And did we take on extra? Damn right we did. People were out sick and we couldn't come to work. If we sneezed, they'd send us home. So somebody had to pick up the slack, and that was the people that were able to be there. And we did that. So, yeah, it was something, to say the least.
We thank Laura Belen and journalist George Clark for that interview with UAW Representative J.D. Neal in Des Moines, Iowa. I'm A classic by Herbie Hancock, Chameleon. As the COVID pandemic continues to upend the lives of first responders throughout the country, union leaders representing sanitation workers have concerns about the dangers and risk they face each day without proper protective gear and unanswered requests for hazard pay. Pacifica's veteran host of To Heal DC, Joni Eisenberg, talks to Robert Hollingsworth, Executive Director of District Council 20, the largest public sector union in the District of Columbia, and Kevin Pope, President of Local 2091, AFSCME.
I'd like to dedicate this show in particular to an ancestor by the name of Morris Tolson, who was the president of Local 2091 when we worked together in beginning. So welcome, Chuck.
Thank you, Joni.
And tell us your particular history with AFSCME DC 20.
Well, I started off, I worked at the Martin Luther King Library. I became union president, and then I ended up being on the executive board where, one, I served for many, many years as a political action director, and pretty much we just, Council 20 recommended that we decided who we should endorse for elected office. Then I ended up being head of the president of the council, and at some point we were under receivership and we came out. I became the executive director of Council 20 as well as the president of Council 20. So I've had a long history with Council 20 on many, many faces. Have always enjoyed working with Council 20 and with union people, because if it hadn't been for union people, most of us wouldn't be where we are today.
Yes, and could you please introduce first guest, Robert Hollingsworth.
Robert Hollingsworth is the new executive director of Council 20, and I have found this brother to be very, very sharp, very concerned about our members and willing to work and listen. And so while we've lost Andrew, I think that we're in good hands, and I would urge everybody to do two things. One, work with him and be supportive of him like we have been for other executive directors. But I think we're in absolutely great shape, and he has some wonderful concepts and ideas and stories about the union. So with that introduction, Brother Robert.
Good morning. My name is Robert Hollingsworth, and as I said, I'm Executive Director of AFSCME District Council 20 here in Washington, D.C. We've just celebrated our 50th year here in the District of Columbia. And as Chuck has been speaking to you, he's told you that he is also a part of that history. AFSCME District Council 20 represents a little over 8,000 workers in the District of Columbia, from the private sector to the municipal sector, as well as the federal sector. Sectors of government. Sanitation workers, as you know, many of you remember back in 1968 when Dr. King was in Memphis in support of the sanitation workers. At that time, two men had been crushed on February 1st of 1968. Two men, Echo Cole and Robert Walker, were crushed while trying to find shelter in their truck from the weather. Because of a malfunction, they were killed. On February 12th, the workers in the city of Memphis, all 1,300 sanitation workers, decided that enough was enough. They had tried to organize in 1963, 1964, and 1966, and faced retaliation from management for doing so. As a teenager at that time, growing up in Memphis, I was well aware of working conditions of the sanitation employees. Some of the workers in the neighborhood that I lived in worked for the sanitation department, and many worked for the city of Memphis. And it was interesting to see the buildup and the anticipation, as everyone knew that Dr. King was coming to Memphis in support of the sanitation workers. Sanitation workers, you know, you have to realize this is one of the most hazardous jobs on the planet. In any country, any nation that you look into, if you look at what the most dangerous jobs are, you will see sanitation work near the top of the list. So we're here today to talk about our sanitation workers, and just wanted to let them know, and they need to hear from you, how much we appreciate them and respect them for what they put forward. Dr. King said it, disease is rampant without the sanitation worker. So we all must always remember they are essential to our cities properly functioning and us maintaining the level of health that we expect to have in this city.
Thank you, Robert. And one thing you had mentioned to me lately is that sanitation workers, I think you said, are the fifth highest, most dangerous job. I don't know if that's nationally or locally.
Nationally and worldwide as well for that risk that they face. You know, sanitation workers are exposed to various gases. They're exposed to all types of liquids. But there are so many risks that they face that the public is just not aware of.
Absolutely. And that's why we are calling the sanitation workers. They are our invisible heroes. We hear a lot about the nurses. And of course, you know, we should hear about them based on the challenges they face every day. But we also need to honor and recognize and support the DC sanitation workers. I know in New York City, they used to, in the beginning of the pandemic, some folks on our sister station used to encourage everybody to lean out their windows and cheer and clap at noon for the nurses. Maybe that's something we can do in DC is cheer and clap for these brave sanitation workers who are our invisible heroes. And we're going to be listening now to two people who represent their union, these invisible heroes. First, we're going to hear from Kevin Pogue, who is the new president of Local 2091, I believe the youngest president elect. Welcome, Kevin.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
We're glad you're here with us. Maybe you can start out with explaining to listeners, you represent many people in Local 2091, including 500 sanitation workers in D.C. Give us a little glimpse of the basic stresses before COVID. And you yourself have been out there for many decades. Give our listeners a brief feeling of the basic stresses and dangers that the sanitation workers experience in general.
Okay, most definitely. First, my name is Kevin Pogue. I'm the president of Local 2091. It's a pleasure to be here to speak about this morning. What we do in the district, I think, and I've seen it for years, I've been in labor for over 20 years. And what we do with our sanitation workers is we put our trash out in the morning and we expect that when we get home that it'll be gone. And you don't even see them half the time. They get out, they get the work done, whether it's rain, sleet, snow, cold, just like the mailman. We go out and we do what we're supposed to do. But we have hazards. Like my brother, Mr. Hollingsworth was saying, we have hazards. We deal with everything. We deal with trash. Just think about that for a minute. Those men and women get up in the morning and they go out there and they deal with what you don't want in your home anymore. We also deal with homeless encampments. These things we've been asking, the personal protection equipment we've been asking the city for and the upgrade of the PPE for a while now and haven't seen that happen. We work with outdated and unsafe vehicles. These trucks, just like the sanitation workers that died in those trucks trying to get out of the rain, we got guys that some of these packers don't even work the way they're supposed to work, but we have to make them work, have a job to do. We have to get this trash up. All these things that we're going through within a pandemic, not just any pandemic, but a pandemic where it's airborne. You can go home, go in the house and infect your family, and then you're out of work, and then somebody's in the hospital, and next thing you know, they're gone. So not only are we dealing with the things that the trash already brings, we're dealing with the added stress of the pandemic right now. We have guys that just stand over in the cold on Benning Road dump site, just stand over in the cold. We've asked the city for a trailer so those guys wouldn't be standing in the cold the whole 8 or 12 hour shift that they're out there. That has yet to happen. And remember, these guys need to be able to go somewhere to wash their hands, use the restroom, because we are in a pandemic. We're asking the city just to pay attention to the sanitation workers. Sanitation workers are the unsung heroes. Just imagine, I know people watch the news and you see the rats taking over New York City. Can you imagine if our sanitation workers weren't doing their job properly, the rats would have been taking over D.C.? God knows. And in these homeless encampments, the things that we have to deal with, those men and women go out there and they clean up feces. They clean up needles. They don't have the proper gear to do these things. And we've been asking the city this for a long time. And that's on top of the pandemic. Can you imagine how stressful that is? Can you imagine having to come home, take your clothes off at the front door just so you can go in the house? That's the type of job these men and women have. And we were not treating them the correct way in a pandemic in the greatest city on the earth. I just think that we can do a whole lot better. We have guys that have worked these jobs for 20 and 30 years, beating their bodies up. Life expectancy for a sanitation worker is very, very short. Mr. Hollingsworth said that it's at the top of the list as being one of the most dangerous jobs ever. Can you imagine why? Can you imagine the diseases that you take home? Can you imagine what you breathe in? Can you imagine what you touch every day? And then we come into a situation like we have now with COVID-19. Oh, man, added stress, added pressure. Can you imagine what that does to somebody's health, let alone their health, but their mental health? Not just the physical health, but the mental health. We should be thankful. And like you said, Ms. Joni, we should be thanking these guys, hanging out the windows, waving at them. You should know their name. You should know who's on your route. Because you just put your trash out. And when you get home from work, you just know it's gone.
Absolutely. And again, you're listening to Kevin Pogue, who's the president of Local 2091, part of Ask Me, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees District Council 20, which is the union that represents the largest number of D.C. workers.
Thanks to Joni Eisenberg of WPFW Washington, D.C., along with Robert Hollingsworth, Executive Director of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union, commonly known as AFSCME, and to Kevin Pogue, who represents 500 sanitation workers in Washington, D.C., Local 2091 of AFSCME. Both are unsung heroes, and we thank them for their service.
All my life, been grinding all my life. Sacrifice, hustle paid the price. Want a slice, got to roll the dice. That's why all my life, I've been grinding all my life. Yeah. All my life, been grinding all my life. Sacrifice, hustle paid the price. Want a slice, got to roll the dice. That's why all my life, I've been grinding all my life.
Yeah. The great Nipsey Hussle, grinding all my life. On February 4th this week, ballots will be going out for the second vote for the Amazon Bessemer workers in Alabama. The NLRB ruled that owner Jeff Bezos had flagrantly violated union labor rights. Workers now face death on the job and are hoping there will be changes with the new vote. Here are some of their voices.
A man in my department, now he worked a night shift, so it was before the day shift, which I worked day shift. He had died on the job.
Apparently he had a stroke and died inside the trailer. From my understanding, he was inside the trailer for probably 20 minutes before someone realized they hadn't seen him and went in the trailer and found him on the floor dead.
He had gone to HR and said, I'm not feeling so well. Can I please go home? Because, you know, a lot of folks, even myself, we don't even have enough UPT, which is unpaid time off, right? And if you go negative, they'll get rid of you like that. And so a lot of people are terrified of that. And this dude, he didn't have enough to go home. And so what HR told him was, you're just going to have to speak to management and see what they can do.
And they're going to realize that they can do a whole lot more together.
I want to be able to have the opportunity to move up and get treated fast.
Those were the voices of Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Zeltzer and Akua Holt. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and our Facebook page at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.